Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening this week. I'm Jared Serbu. On the program this time, a deep dive into military personnel management within the Navy. Our guest for the full hour is Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel, and he says he's at the start of a serious conversation with the other military services and with Congress about how to modernize the military's approach to talent management. Moran says the current linear up or out model for career development is a bad fit for a generation that wants to explore different opportunities, especially early in their working lives. He thinks the personnel system needs more on and off ramps that would allow service members to take a pause in their military careers, to go to school, start a family, maybe work in the private sector for a couple years, and then come back. The bottom line, Moran says, is that the current system is too inflexible.
You know, it's a 67-year-old system that was designed back in the late 40s to address several issues, I'm sure, that evolved out of World War II. The size of the officer corps, trying to neck it down, not allowing it to become too senior and top-heavy, and having this kind of pyramid structure. So they put in rule sets and management levers that kept it in this kind of pyramid structure. And with that, and it has stayed that way, evolved a little bit, but it stayed that way ever since. Mm-hmm. And now you've got a workforce, potential workforce, either through the recruits or the people who are already on active duty, who are living in a world of information that moves quickly. It's interconnected. You know, the world is flat, as Tom Friedman's written about, and everybody kind of buys into that. But it really is true that ideas are shared frequently and often, so there's a lot more information available to people out there. And with that comes this kind of challenge for us to keep people focused on their desire to serve in a company like the United States Navy, but not be so boxed in on structure and inflexibility in how they manage their careers. So that's probably what's been, and I've gotten that feedback in all my fleet visits. And the dialogue we've been able to have here recently with junior officers throughout the fleet, it kind of started with aviation, but it's blossomed into surface warfare and submariners. So, and it's consistent. You know, they're a little bit frustrated with seeing that if they want to make a career out of the Navy, that they've got to follow this very rigid, very structured career path. And there's method to that kind of madness in our system. It's a big company, and it's somewhat centrally controlled. But I think we can do better if we can have some more flexibility in how you manage people. With it comes the need to get out there and find information systems that allow us to manage it more flexibly. We don't have that today, so there's a little bit of frustration on our part from that standpoint. And then we've got to be able to show young men and women who have enormous talent, who are well educated, who can easily find work in their view outside the Navy, but we want to keep them. We don't have many ways to entice them to stay and to see a career path over the long haul. So when you kind of sum all that up, it's we need more flexibility in the system we have. We need some relief in DOTMA, which is the current statute that governs how we manage the officer career fields and the officer corps itself in all the services. In my conversations with counterparts in the other services, they're also very interested in some freeing up of flexibility inside of DOTMA to allow them to manage their force differently. So that was the essence of the op-ed, was to kind of let's get the ideas, let's get the dialogue out there, see what kind of response we get, and then take it forward to places that matter. We've got to talk to OSD, we've got to talk to Capitol Hill, and we've got to talk among the services, because it has to be a joint solution. It can't be a Navy solution or an Army solution. So it's all of those things together that have that got us to the point where we decided to throw an op-ed out there get a little bit a wider audience, and also to talk internally and externally to both sailors, officers, and those influencers that can perhaps affect the way we look at DOTMA in the future.
To put everything you just said in kind of a nutshell, you used the phrase closed loop, talking about the personnel system. It's kind of a closed loop personnel system in a society where information is no longer a closed loop, and the way people think about their careers is no longer a closed loop. Let's play with that idea a little bit. How unique is that to this current generation of whatever, 18 to 26-year-olds, and to what extent has this been an ongoing or blossoming issue over a longer period of time?
Well, certainly this generation, whether they're millennials or something else, certainly those younger than me are talking to me a lot about having more freedom of choice about what they do next. And of course, the Navy is somewhat unique. I can't speak for the Air Force and the Army on this, but certainly from the Navy with seashore rotations and this idea that we've got to constantly rotate people from sea duty to shore duty back to sea throughout a career, it really limits their ability to break from that flow to do things like start a family if they're wearing a uniform, to get a master's degree at an institution that may not be affiliated with the Navy in a formal way. So go to Harvard, go to Penn State, go to Villanova, go to where they would like to go to get a master's degree in a field they're very interested in. Naturally, we would like to see them go get educated in a field that would benefit the Navy so that when they come back, they've improved their resume and their marketability inside the Navy. But there are very few opportunities for junior officers to accomplish that. And in some career fields, like aviation in particular, the training pipeline is so long that it further pressurizes their relatively short first 10 years in the Navy. And that's the sweet spot for starting a family. Well, first of all, to meet somebody, to marry somebody, to then start a family. Those are all challenges with that generation. When they look at it long term, many of them look at it and say, I don't see how I can fit a career in there, even though I like the Navy. I like the fact that I'm wearing a uniform. I'm serving my country. I like that calling. I just don't see the flexibility in the system that would allow me to go out and explore different opportunities, different experiences, and then come back. So we've got to figure out mechanisms that allow people this generation to do those things, because I think they will go and they will want to come back once they get those experiences. Our current system is up or out. And if you want to move up, then you're going to follow a very structured, if I said closed loop, what I really meant was a very structured path with not a lot of choice. So I don't think this generation appreciates that structure so much as maybe I did. And so how do we accommodate that? As you refer to, in an information age, it's moving quickly, and opportunities appear very quickly, and then they have to make a choice. It's up or it's out. I'd like to see it's up with different off-ramps and on-ramps. Let people get out for a period of time to do what they want to do, get a better experience, become more mature. And what I mean by that is simply having experiences that mature how they think, so that when they come back into the Navy, assuming they want to come back in, we get a more disciplined, probably a more mature thinker that benefits the Navy, like any corporation would benefit people like that.
That's Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. We'll come back and talk about some of the approaches the Navy's trying to make the personnel system more flexible and the legal changes he thinks are needed after our first break. This is on DOD, on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on FederalNewsRadio.com at 1500 AM, this is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. We're talking this hour with Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. As we discussed before the break, he wrote an op-ed earlier this month with the hope of starting a conversation about bringing more flexibility to the military personnel system, including more ways for service members to move in and out of military service.
And I want to talk more about some of your ideas on what to change, but something that strikes me is whenever I hear any of the leaders of the five armed services talk about the quality of the workforce that you have right now in uniform, they say it's the best we've ever had. Mm-hmm. So why mess with a good thing, I guess, is one question that comes up. What you have right now seems to be producing some extremely high-quality people.
Yeah, we do, but we do it in an industrial fashion. We bring in a lot of people, expecting a lot of people to leave, and the residue that's left over from that industrial process is good quality, but it's very expensive. For example, we've got to bring in roughly 1,000 ensigns in the surface warfare field to get to 300 or so department heads 5 years later. So we're planning on a 35% retention rate, roughly. Is that good or bad? I would argue that it's inefficient. And we don't always have a place for all those 1,000 ensigns to go. And so they get out there and they get frustrated. The ships that they go to are frustrated because they have more people than they really need at that level. So there's not useful work and meaningful work for them and meaningful opportunities to train to be qualified as surface warfare officers. So it's a struggle right now. So we fundamentally have to figure out a way to change that math problem because it's about money. It's very expensive. So that's what drives me in that direction. There's chapter and verse in every community on the inefficiencies of the system we've put into place. And people have gotten very expensive. It's been written about in all the discussions about pay and compensation. People are very expensive. So when you look at it from a business perspective only, you're going to be inclined, like I am, to figure out how to lower the cost to people. You can either cut their pay, which nobody wants to do, completely alter the retirement program, nobody wants to do, change health benefits, which nobody wants to do, or you're more efficient in how you attract and retain those people, high-quality people. Now, the economy and the war over the last 10 to 15 years has had a lot to do with the quality of people that have joined. You get high-quality people who want to serve their country in a time of conflict. That's evident from 9/11 on. A really lousy economy, which hit bottom in 2008, 2009, has kept a lot of quality people in and has also attracted a lot of quality young folks who might have graduated from high school, gone to the workforce, couldn't find meaningful work, and said, you know what, the Navy or the armed services look pretty attractive to me. And so what that's translated into is the higher number or percentage of folks who are high school graduates. We're in the high 90th percentile now. ASVAB scores or entrance exams results have gone up at the same time because you're getting a more mature, higher educated person applying for work in the Navy. And so, yeah, it's a higher quality when you measure those things and also measuring motivation. So all of that is true. And the net result is if you're bringing in higher quality, you're going to end up with a higher quality no matter what kind of industrial model you have for managing those people. Mm-hmm. That will change. We know it's going to change. It's the one thing that absolutely keeps me thinking every day about what's going to happen when the economy turns around, and it will. Don't know when. When that happens, will the quality still be there at the front end? And will we be able to keep the quality on the back end? And we're not in a position to flexibly react to that right now.
And I think one of the effects of that is that your sister services in particular are going through some pretty angstful choices right now and getting rid of a lot of high-quality people that they really would rather hang on to.
Right.
Navy, I think, is doing a lot less of that painful downsizing, but you've done it in the past, over the past decade. What lessons do you think you learned about good ways and bad ways to go through a downsizing?
Yeah, you know, the Navy since 9/11, when you combine the active and reserve force, has come down 90,000 people. It's a lot of folks at a time of war and conflict. it was necessary, frankly, to pay for the things we needed to buy to make sure we had a sustainable Navy that could support conflict around the world. So we designed ships differently. We designed new weapon systems differently to be more efficient in the manpower requirements. That said, we had a lot more time to get to that number. The Army, the unfortunate part for the Army and the Air Force and our other sister services is that they're having to do it pretty quickly. There's no easy way to do that, and it's very painful. And I see it in the eyes of my counterparts when I meet with them, that none of them like to ask people who've had five combat tours under their belts to go home before they have a retirement check. You know, those are tough, tough choices. So if you can gradually reduce the force, that's a lot more attractive way to do it because you can manage it better. And so we were fortunate in that we were able to manage it over a long time. We did do a involuntary force reduction back in 2011, 2012, called the Enlisted Retention Board, or ERB, which was aimed at trying to relieve pressure in enlisted ratings, which were overmanned to a point where there was stagnation in advancement opportunity. And we didn't execute that terribly well, nor did we communicate it very well to the fleet. And it's still a burr in the saddle of every enlisted member out there. They still believe that because we did it once, we're going to do it again. And then they look at what's going on in the Army and the Air Force, the necessary means that they've got to use to get down in their numbers, and they see it happening around them, and it reinforces their belief that we're going to do that. If there's one message I have for them, and we share this at every opportunity when I'm out and about and write about it, is we're not going to do another ERB. We have no reason to do another ERB. We're more balanced. We're more stable. Our profile for the size of the Navy is consistent for as far out as the budget looks. So we're not in a downsizing environment. So we should not have to do, we will not do another ERB or involuntary action like that. I'm lucky. I really am lucky in the Navy because we're not in the same position as the Army and the Air Force.
Well, that's kind of a nice place to be because you can sit back and strategize a little bit. So let's talk about some of that strategy and in terms of the inflexibility that you talked about in the personnel system. Talk me through some of the things that you'd like to try, either within your current authorities or if you see the kind of legislative or policy changes that you're after.
Somebody somewhere 5-6 years ago had the wisdom to generate a program called Career Intermission Program. And it's essentially gives service members all the services. So this was written in the statute about 5-6 years ago. Congress listened to us and gave us the authority to have a pilot program that amounted to, for the Navy, 40 slots a year open to male, female, officer, and enlisted. So 40 slots out of 325,000 is pretty small, but it's a pilot. We wanted to see if people would take it, and we also wanted to see over time whether people who took that opportunity to leave the service for up to 3 years, you could take it for any period of time, 1 to 3 years, you owe that back to the Navy when you come back. You keep your ID card, you keep your medical privileges, that sort of thing, but you don't get your regular base pay, so it's a sabbatical. Mm-hmm. So not everybody will want to do that just simply because of the pay difference. But like many corporations around the world, they offer sabbaticals to people who have the means and are in a position where they can go take a year, 2, 3 years to do a master's program, a doctorate program, start a family, or do whatever they want to do to have different experiences to see if they really want to make the Navy a career or not. So we've had that authority for 5 years, and that's been helpful. Our take rates have been less than I would have expected, and the feedback I get from sailors out there is that I'm not sure I want to roll the dice on my career on a pilot program. I mean, show me that it's not going to hurt my career. Well, in the early stages, you can't show them because you haven't had a board, there haven't been selection processes in place. Well, we're now starting to get into the larger percentage of folks that are finishing up their CIP time out of the Navy. And every single one that I'm aware of now has come back and successfully moved on. Some have selected for the next higher pay grade, officer and enlisted. Some have selected for the next milestone, like a major commander in the aviation community who got out for a couple of years, came back in. So they're starting to come in, and they're starting to show that you can go do this and it won't be held against you. And if that builds, I believe that the program will then be attractive, but will be limited to 40, and it'll be very difficult. So I have been working with members of the congressional staff level to say, hey, here's some thoughts about why I think we might want to look at greater authorities inside that very good program that you have given to us. And if you give us those authorities, we think we might be able to manage this talent a little better. One of our biggest challenges in all the services, but I'll just speak to the Navy, is we can't retain women, younger women, in that first 10 years of service at anywhere near the same rate as men. No surprise, you know, when you're 20, 25 to 30, that's your prime window for meeting partners, having children. Those are big demands on women. But we don't have a means to manage our way through that. There's no flexibility in career paths. SIP is the first real attempt at doing that. But again, very limited in scope. And also there are some restrictions inside that statute that don't allow us to do it for the early years because we have them under a minimum service requirement, an MSR. There's a contract with each one of them for 5 to 8 years, depending on which warfare specialty they are. So why would we open up an opportunity for them to leave if we've already got them? To me, that's short-sighted. Many of them are in their prime window of when they want the opportunity to have that intermission to do all the things we talked about.
Sure.
But the law doesn't allow it. So Congress is, at least at the staffer level, has been very willing to listen to those ideas. And we owe them a report on how we're doing, and we owe them some ideas about what added flexibility, what added authorities would be useful in helping us balance that.
Vice Admiral Bill Moran is the Chief of Naval Personnel. We'll talk more about recruiting and retaining women in the Navy after another break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servid. Thanks for listening to On DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. And back to our conversation now with Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel. We're talking about his new push to find agreement between the military services and with Congress on ways to make the military personnel system more flexible and inculcate some new ideas on talent management. Before our last break, he told us the expansion of tools like the Career Intermission Program show a lot of promise for retaining sailors during their first 10 years of service, and in particular, women.
Let's stay on that idea real quick. As far as retaining women in that first 10 years, talk about why that's important. One that comes to my mind is if you don't have women in that pipeline who are a little bit more senior, you don't have mentors and leaders who are women who the younger women in the fleet can look up to and learn from.
That's exactly right. So if you don't retain high-quality women, just like high-quality men, you're going to have a hard time with the younger generation looking up and saying, there's an opportunity for me.
So it's self-reinforcing.
It's self-reinforcing. Today, we have 25 female O6s in the unrestricted line. 25. That's it. And I imagine we're doing pretty good compared to some. To me, that's a problem if you're trying to, you know, we're mandated by Congress and by law to open up career opportunities in every career field in the Navy. And we've done that in the Navy across every occupation with the exception of SEALs and special boat crews right now. Well, when you only have 17% of your workforce female and you're opening up more opportunity, you're spreading that population very thin across multiple occupations. There's this thing we call critical mass. You need to have a certain population, a percentage of females in organizations to have critical mass. In other words, they look around and they see support mechanisms, leadership, and an ability to affiliate in a way that gives them confidence to grow in that career field. So when you're spreading that base out even thinner, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to reach critical mass. in any one of them. So to me, that means we've got to bring in more women.
And I think you just had your biggest academy class in terms of proportion of women that you've ever had. So you've got an opportunity there at least.
We do. But if we don't retain them at a higher rate, we're going to have to bring in more and more. And that becomes a very expensive proposition in itself. So I'm not confident yet that we have the market to do this unless we change the behavior of retention. And inside the current law on Dotman, how we manage careers, we don't have the flexibility to deal with that. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So there's a real challenge there. And that's why it's going to take a dialogue with all the services, with Congress, and with OSD to find out if we don't want to keep our head in the sand on how we practice personnel management, what things can we do that can be applied broadly that get us where we want to be, which is retaining the best talent we can.
Mm-hmm. Back to your experiences so far with SIP, you mentioned that it doesn't look like it's been a career killer so far for the people who have done it. I wonder why you think that is. Is it because promotion boards are looking at that as something that adds value to that individual sailor, or are they just not paying much attention to it either way?
Yeah, I would say there are plenty of aspects to this. One is under SIP, when you leave, let's say I'm not just making this up, but let's say you're a year group 08 person when you get out for SIP and you take 3 years. When you come back in, you're a year group 11 person. So on your record, what they're going to see is progression like everybody else based on where you stopped and picked back up. If we kept them in the same year group, there's no way they'd be successful because they would see this break in their career path and they can't compete against their peers. So that's one. That's a way to get at it. The other one is to make sure that the boards are fully educated on what SIP is for and what those folks are doing. The feedback I've gotten anecdotally from board members who have seen records come during the boards that have SIP-related careers is they don't see any issue at all. They're able to just watch the records being flashed up there, and all they're looking for is continuity in that record. And so the breaks don't show up because they're, like I said, all anybody sees is the record. Now, they can tell when somebody came in and go, wow, that they came in a little earlier than this year group. Why is that? And there's an explanation that they went out for 2 years, got a master's program, and then came back in. But as long as they're able to maintain performance at the same level with the same experiences as the cohort that's being looked at in that board, they're going to compete. They're going to be fine. Those are our safeguards, if you will, to make sure the program, the folks that participate in the program aren't disadvantaged. And so far, I can't cite a single case where somebody's been disadvantaged.
So one last thing on the career intermission program. You said you're capped at 40 now. Do you know what the optimal number is that you'd like authority for?
Optimally, Jared, I want to institutionalize it. In other words, I don't have limits. We let the market drive it. And initially, that'll be very hard to do because if you have this groundswell of folks that say, I just want to go do this, we're not going to have the depth and enough folks behind them to fill in. But once we get into a rhythm, we could scale this over time, gradually fill or open it up larger and larger until we can institutionalize it. But that's one aspect. AC to RC and RC back to AC is another method that we're looking, that we'd like to look at and have more authorities. We think we already have some authorities to do that, but we haven't exercised it as much as we'd like.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about AC to RC, because run active component to reserve component, for folks who don't know the acronyms, because right now I think that's basically a one-way valve. If you get out of active duty and you go to the reserve component, you're unlikely to go back to active in general. Is that about right?
That's how it's been implemented in the past. We have the authorities. For example, last year we had over 200 enlisted sailors who were RC, came on to active duty, and they had to apply for it. And they had to be in a specific rate to fill a specific billet at a specific pay grade. And as long as they met that criteria and the demand was there and they had good performance and, you know, didn't have any other issues, they got approved to come in. We haven't done it as much, nearly as much, in the officer community. So, and therefore, it's not viewed as a typical path that you could take when you enter in the active force. I'd like to see us experiment with that some more and allow people to go RC for a couple years or longer. There's probably a sweet spot that you don't want to get out for 10 years and come back. But a couple years, much like SIP, a couple, 3 years, and then come back in. Think of the money we save in training, recruiting, educating. We would have to retrain. We'd have to refresh, but we wouldn't have to go through the full cycle again. That saves us money. And it gains you a more mature, more experienced employee, if you will, service member. So I like what the possibilities are there. And Admiral Braun and I are at the staff level talking about how we could do this with more fluidity, if you will. And where we need more authorities, that's our opportunity to go to Congress and say, along with the other services, to say, here are some changes we'd like you to consider in DOTMA or whatever the statute is that governs this, and help us out so that we have another path besides SIP.
Vice Admiral Bill Moran is the Chief of Naval Personnel. He'll join us for one more segment after we take one more break. This is on DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servier. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Talking this week with Vice Admiral Bill Moran, the Chief of Naval Personnel, about possible reforms to the military personnel system. He thinks it needs to become a lot more flexible to attract and retain members of the millennial generation. Moran wants to expand the use of programs that let service members take a voluntary pause in their military service and then return after a few years.
Back to your conversations with your sister services, I mean, it's great and it's interesting that you're looking at different ways to run the personnel system, but are you a voice in the wilderness at this point, or are your counterparts in the Army, Air Force, Coast Guard also saying we need to look at this in a different way?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give full credit to the Army. The Army really, I believe, started this conversation several years ago, and they've got a group up at West Point that looks at these kind of asymmetric ways of thinking about the future, and they're very talented folks up there. We got to go up and visit them earlier this spring. We've been thinking about this, but not as detailed and certainly not as comprehensively as this team at West Point's done. That said, my counterparts in the Army have been pretty clear-eyed about we're in the middle of a large force reduction. We're not as interested in some of the creative ways to keep people in. So they're in a tough spot. But I told them if this is a long-term objective, beyond when you settle out and beyond post-war, and we want to be in a better position to manage people and manage talent, we'll help run the ball down the field because we are in a position, because of our stability, to really argue for changes to DOTMA that will help us out in the shorter term. Going into it, though, with an absolute team effort with all the services. I have received encouraging signs from all the services that this is something they're very interested in. So there's a meeting later this afternoon, which our team is participating in the Pentagon, sponsored by the Army, along these very lines. So I give full credit to the Army on this, but we're running as fast as we can to explore ways to get more flexibility in the system as soon as we can. Because this is not going to go away.
And we've talked mostly about ways for people to take a break from active duty and come back in. Are there bigger bang changes that need to happen to the overall personnel system to accommodate what we talked about before, the millennial generation, attract and retain them?
Jared, if I could flash myself forward, I don't know how many years into the future, and saw information technology and management systems that were modern and efficient and effective that would allow us to get to a more of a market-based approach to assigning and managing careers and managing talent. Boy, that's nirvana to me. And it's a complete, it flips the industrial DOTMA model that we have today on its head. And gets rid of the centralized control and authorities of managing quantity of people and gets much more towards personalized individual management of talent and letting commands and unit commanders have much more say in who they want to bring in than today, which is dictated by BUPERS. Eventually, what I'm telling you is maybe put ourselves out of a job. And that would be an interesting place. You think about, we were kicking this around the other day, IBM, which is about the same size as the Navy, 300,000 plus employees around the world, lots of units and companies out there that support the headquarters. But those local companies and units, the presidents and CEOs, otherwise called COs in the fleet, have the authority to hire and fire and to attract and retain talent based on what they see they need in their local unit, their local company. But they all work for IBM. Imagine us in a similar place. And I'm sure there's plenty of people out there that might be listening to this that have had my job or have worked in personnel going, that's impossible.
Sounds like heresy.
You can't possibly do that. Well, they're right today. But if you like the notion that you get to deal in that and put more power to local commanders to make those kind of decisions about the talent they need and the talent they want to keep, boy, that changes the game. And it actually, I think, will tend to attract the top quality to stay in because they see a path. And they don't have to stand in line like they do today. Interestingly, right? So if you're a junior officer, you don't get any special consideration outside of your year group. And sometimes those year groups split into screen groups depending on the size and the shape. And so you're not looked at for a milestone tour, even though you may be ready, until that year group gets in zone, until that screen group gets in zone. So that's very frustrating to highly motivated, highly talented folks. But it also is frustrating to those that want to slow it down a little bit to be able to start a family, to go back to school. I use this example all the time. Naval Academy midshipmen who are selected for Rhodes Scholars. I mean, these kids are really smart, talented young men and women. And there are very few Rhodes Scholars every year, and Naval Academy has had pretty good success, and some of our ROTC programs have had pretty good success getting Rhodes Scholars or MIT Scholars or Olmsted Scholars later on in their career. They all require up to a couple of years, if not longer, of a break for education. Well, they're inside a year group now that's off and running, and they're in the race to the next promotion, and now they're stuck in non-observed fitness reports for 2 to 3 years only to come back and compete against their brothers and sisters that have been at sea, operating ships, aircrafts, submarines, and other things. Imagine if we had the flexibility to freeze those folks, still pay them, but let them go to these very distinguished schools and motivate them to stay in the Navy by giving them a chance without having to accelerate everything they do from that point on to shorten their first sea tour, to shorten their first shore tour, just to catch up. That's what we make them do because we have no flexibility in the system. So there's another good example to me that, you know, you'll hear it out there from junior officers. The Navy does not value higher education. Well, we value it. We just don't accommodate it. And we don't necessarily have the means to accommodate it because the career paths are so tightly woven together. And there are other examples, test pilots, test engineers, others who have to take a break and go out and get an education to get the qualifications to then be able to serve as a test, you name it. But they still want to compete. They still want to be commanding officers somewhere. They still want to be able to go back to sea. But it's very difficult for them to do that because they're stuck in these year groups. So I hear that a lot from folks, and there's been a lot of good dialogue from JOs out there. I just wish we could change this aspect of it. And so that's part of the conversation as well.
On a really closely related topic, and we've only got a few minutes left, but I want to make sure I ask you about the upper out issue. You mentioned it both your op-ed and in our conversation, mm-hmm. that this idea that if you're passed over for promotion a couple times, it's time to go. Does that policy specifically need a relook?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I mean, I think if a board's looked at someone a couple times and they're not going to promote, then that person needs to move on to make room for others coming up behind them. I mean, in the interim of getting to nirvana, we still have to have flow. You still have to have people at the lowest levels feeling like they've got opportunity to move up in the organization. To do that, people have to move out. They either have to leave or they have to retire when they get to the appropriate point. Because of the economic conditions we've had for the last several years, people aren't leaving. We've got fabulous retention, especially the more senior you get. Whether it's 06s, 05s, and 04s, or it's chief petty officers, senior chief petty officers, master chiefs, they're staying around a lot longer than they used to. So that's an aspect that could change overnight. And again, that's why we don't want to inadvertently pull a lever and then find out the economy pulled its own lever at the same time, and now you find yourself in a real pickle. So we don't have good predictive models that allow us to sit here on a daily basis and look at those screens and say, looks like we're going to have a pretty righteous turn in unemployment in next quarter, and we predict A, B, and C effects on retention. Those don't exist today. And believe me, we've had a lot of conversations with some pretty smart people, and it always comes down to, don't know. Could be. Might happen. I just know over the long haul, this downward cycle in the economy is going to reverse itself. How fast it reverses itself and the slope that it corrects will have an immediate impact on our ability to attract and retain good, high-quality people.
Admiral, it's been a really interesting hour. Thanks so much for talking to us, and I wish you the best of luck as you work through these issues.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Vice Admiral Bill Moran is the Chief of Naval Personnel. As he mentioned, he wrote a recent op-ed on the topics we've been discussing, adding more flexibility to the personnel system. We'll post a link to that op-ed along with this entire interview at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. That's going to do it for this week's program. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.